And when in later life he suffered exquisitely, terribly, he wandered once more among the dirty streets. He had to return to the cold, stony-hearted stepmother of his suffering, London. He started to walk through the city at dead of night. He'd always walked it during the day. But now he was for the dark. Now the night enters his head. He becomes the child again, experiencing the horror of London. He visits the prisons, the madhouses, the workhouses. Suddenly, a thing that in a moment I should have trod upon without seeing rose up at my feet with a cry of loneliness and houselessness, the like of which I never heard. We then stood face to face, looking at one another, frightened by one another. The creature was a beetle-browed, hair-lipped youth of 20, and it had a loose bundle of rags on, which it held together with one of its hands. It shivered from head to foot, and its teeth chattered. And as it stared at me, persecutor, devil, ghost, whatever it thought me, it made with its whining mouth as if it was snapping at me like a worried dog. Intending to give this ugly object money, I put out my hand to stay it, for it recoiled as it whined and snapped, and laid my hand upon its shoulder. Instantly it twisted out of its garment, like the young man in the New Testament, and left me standing there, with its rags in my hand. What could he do? How could he help? As ever, he flung himself into his work. I'm in a regular, ferocious excitement. I get up at 7 in the morning, have a cold bath before breakfast, and blaze away, wrathful and red-hot. My eyes have grown immensely large. My hair is very lank, and the head inside the hair is hot and giddy. He attacks a grotesque legal system and a bad, incompetent government, a blundering civil service and a hypocritical clergy. He attacks the employers and the unions, teachers and philanthropists. In fact, the whole nation and society of England were under siege. I must deliver a sledgehammer blow. I am in desperate earnest. And why should I not be in earnest when I am fighting the world? A man who could do nothing by halves, Dickens's friend Wilkie Collins said of him, appears to me to be a fearful man. He knew it. He knew it well enough of himself. He knew his imagination was desperately strange, and that he himself was sometimes accused of being mad. Mad people were strangely attracted to Dickens and sent him letters. One gentleman, distracted by the death of his son, remarking upon the peculiar contortions of the body, declared, "Ah, there's a point for Mr. Dickens." In his novels, he loved to impersonate those on the very edge of sanity. We may call them eccentric or insane, but the effects are pretty much the same.
Ha! Phoebus! How goes the world? I'll tell you what. I shouldn't wish it to be mentioned, but it's a mad world, boy. Mad as Bedlam. Come into school. Do you recollect the date when King Charles I had his head cut off? The book said it happened in the year 1649, but I don't see how that can be, because if it was so long ago, how could the people about him have made that mistake of putting some of the trouble out of his head when it was taken off into mine? Hey, what would you think of that for a kite? Eh? Boy, we'll go and fly it, you and I. You see, I've covered it in manuscript written by me. There's plenty of string, and when it flies high, it takes the facts far away. That's my manner of diffusing them. I don't know where they may come down. It's according to circumstances and the wind and so forth, but I take my chance of that.
There are others who say that Dickens was possessed by female voices, and that he loathed as much as he loved his mother, his sisters, his wife. And out of that crushing imbalance came all the farce and the fury. Certainly he treated his old and widowed mother as a comic character from one of his books. My mother has a strong objection to being considered in the least old, and usually appears here on Christmas Day in a juvenile cap, which takes an immense time in putting on. The instant she recognised me, she plucked up her spirits and asked for a pound. His wife, he wrote, in equally scathing terms. I find that the skeleton in my closet is becoming a pretty big one. It seemed that he could never escape his unhappiness. And then, as it had before in his past more than once, his life changed irrevocably. At the age of 46, Dickens met a young professional actress who had a small part in The Frozen Deep, an Arctic melodrama, which he had written in collaboration with Wilkie Collins. That is to say, he also played the principal part in it, he directed it, he built the scenery. The young actress was called Ellen Ternan. She was 18 years old, and Dickens fell deeply in love with her. Well, no, that's altogether too familiar a phrase. All the desperate intensity of his nature, all the emptiness and all the yearning found their focus in Ellen Ternan. She was the one thing missing from his life. For her, it must have been like walking through fire. Dickens followed her and her family on a theatrical tour around the country. He could not rest or think or write or sleep without the image of that young woman being always before him. And under the pressure of this devastating feeling, he came to a terrible decision. The woman with whom he lived had become insupportable to him. She was ailing, she was clumsy, she was tearful. She was not witty. She was not Ellen. She was growing old. He resented the memories she evoked in him. He was frightened of growing old with her. So what did he do? He behaved exactly as if he were a character in one of his own novels. He gave instructions that the marital bedroom should be divided into two, and he had a brick wall erected between himself and his wife. Then, in the spring of 1858, after 22 years of marriage, Charles Dickens asked his wife for a formal separation without giving the slightest reason whatever. She went back to live with her family. But her younger sister, Georgina, stayed behind and supported Dickens. With Catherine gone, Georgina took charge of the illustrious novelist's household. It was an ugly and a messy business, rendered infinitely worse by Dickens's disturbed and disturbing behaviour. "My father acted like a madman," his daughter confessed later. "This affair brought out all that was worst and all that was weakest in him. He did not care a damn what happened to any of us. Nothing could surpass the misery, the unhappiness of our home." Well, rumours, of course, began to spread that Dickens was having an affair with a young actress, or much worse from his point of view, that he was having an affair with his own sister-in-law, and Dickens, quite simply, lost control. He had a letter printed in the Times in which he condemned misrepresentations most grossly false, most monstrous and most cruel. Slanders passing over the country like unwholesome air. But not one in a thousand readers of the newspaper had the remotest idea what he was talking about. Now, of course, they did. Many other newspapers felt free to publicise the separation and to turn against Dickens in the process. He'd visited upon himself the very fate that he most feared. He shunned many of his oldest friends on the mere suspicion that they had expressed sympathy for his estranged wife, and he was, of course, in turn shunned by them. He changed his publishers because they had not printed his statement in their periodical Punch. He broke down and wept at a lunch at the Athenaeum. He felt harassed, haunted on all sides. He now looked very much older, his face lined with deep furrows, his hair grizzled and thinned, his expression clouded and careworn. He began to write tragically of doomed marriage. I saw that everything within my view, which ought to have been white, had been white long ago, and had lost its luster, and was faded and yellow. I saw that the bride within the bridal dress had withered, like the dress, and like the flowers had no brightness left but the brightness of her sunken eyes. I saw that the dress had been put upon the rounded figure of a young woman, and that the figure upon which it now hung loose had shrunk to skin and bone. I should have cried out if I could. Who is it? Pip, ma'am. Pip! Mr. Pummelchook's boy, ma'am. Come to play.
Come nearer. Let me look at you. Come closer.
It was when I stood before her, avoiding her eyes, that I took note of the surrounding objects in detail, and saw that her watch had stopped at 9:20, and that a clock in the room had stopped at 9:20. "Look at me," said Miss Havisham. "You're not afraid of a woman who has never seen the sun since you were born?"
"No, ma'am."
"Do you know what I touch here?"
she said, laying her hands one upon another on her left side.
"Yes, ma'am."
"What do I touch?"
"Your heart, ma'am.
Broken!"
Yet still he was Charles Dickens. His eyes were still bright, his dress was still loud and theatrical, and he continued to carry himself with almost military precision. The storm, like all storms, passed. Or rather, it hid itself in the heart of Dickens, and in those closest to him whose lives had been changed forever. He gave his wife a house and a carriage in Camden Town. Ellen Turner and her sisters moved into a house beside Oxford Street. Whether he and Ellen were lovers, whether they were ever to become lovers, on that matter he and everyone else always remained silent. There are those who say that it was a sexless intimacy, as between brother and sister, while others have pointed to rumours about their living together at a later date, and even to possible children. Nothing is known for certain. It's one of the great mysteries which Dickens created without pointing to any way through the labyrinth. The personality of Charles Dickens, apparently so transparent, so extrovert, so graspable, proves to be full of dark mysteries. Deeper than all, as Carlyle said of him, if one has eye to see deep enough, one sees dark, fateful, silent elements, tragical to look upon, hiding amid dazzling radiance as of the sun, the elements of death itself. But after all the uproar, scandal over the separation, when Dickens was at his very lowest, he did an astonishing thing. He decided to embark on a reading tour of the entire country. He wanted to find his audience again. He wanted to reach the people he feared he might have lost. He knew his power over them all, but now he wanted to exert it in person. His very first reading was at a Christmas Carol in Edinburgh. He stage-managed it quite brilliantly. He wore a rose in his buttonhole. There was a maroon screen behind him, and he was encircled by gaslight. There must be no one behind me. I must see everyone's face, and they must see mine. Everyone must see my face. He poured himself a tumbler of water from a carafe while the applause subsided. Then he stood in silence for a few moments, looking around at the audience, and it was reported that his wonderful eyes seemed to have the power of meeting those of every separate individual in the audience. "Keep your eyes upon me. Look. Now my eyes are on you.
I need to be connected to you. And you to me.
Then I will be transformed. Then I will come alive.
I am Quilp. I am Pecksniff.
I am the Artful Dodger.
I am Vincent Crummles. He had a different voice for each character. The orotund voice of Sergeant Buzzfuzz. Responsibility. The Cockney Jewish lisp of Fagin.
Suppose that lad of his own fancy, to please his own taste. Suppose he was to do all this. What then, my dear?
The fat boy's whine.
I wants to make your flesh creep.
He had the book on a lectern before him, but of course he didn't need to read his own words. He'd rehearsed them thoroughly and memorized them carefully. He had them in more senses than one. By heart, his audience knew the words too. And perhaps no other writer in the world has had the absolute certainty that his works would be as well known to his readers as they were to himself. His incomparable storytelling as a writer, equalled by his gifts as an actor, held his audience. Spellbound.
Wild applause, tears, cheers, wonderful happiness.
It is such an unspeakable satisfaction to me to have left such an impression here in Edinburgh, in London, Dublin, Huddersfield, Wakefield, York, Harrogate, Scarborough, Hull, Leeds, Halifax, Sheffield, Manchester. All in 11 days. He walked from Durham to Sunderland, and then he walked from Sunderland to Newcastle, and then on to Scotland by the new train. Edinburgh, Dundee, Aberdeen, Perth, Glasgow again. Everywhere the theatres were sold out. Large crowds waited all day and sometimes all night for tickets. And they were not disappointed. They'd come to see the most famous man of the day, and to hear their favourite author read his own words. But they got something more. This was theatre. This was acting at last. Dickens was able to be the actor he had always wanted to be. His hands and body were always in motion, and his face changed so remarkably that he seemed to become the person he was dramatising.
Gemp is my name. Gemp, my nature.
She was a fat old woman, this Mrs. Gamp, with a husky voice and a moist eye which she had a remarkable power of turning up and only showing the white.
Having very little neck, it cost her some trouble to look over herself, if one may say so, at those to whom she talked. She wore a very rusty black gown, rather the worse for snuff, and a shawl and a bonnet to correspond.
The face of Mrs. Gamp, the nose in particular, was somewhat red and swollen, and it was difficult to enjoy her society without becoming conscious of a peculiar fragrance, as if a passing fairy had hiccuped and had previously been to a wine vault. That is why she went to a lying in or a laying out with equal relish. Ah! Repeated Mrs. Gamp, for that was a safe sentiment in cases of mourning.
Oh, when Gamp was summoned to his long home, and I seen him a-lying in Guy's hospital with a penny piece on each eye, and his wooden leg under his left arm, I thought I should have fainted away. But I bore up. The blessing of a daughter was denied to me, which, if we had one, Gamp would certainly have drunk its little shoes right off its feet.
It was their precious boy. He did. Then Mrs. Gamp solaced herself with a pinch of snuff and stood looking at the sick man with her head inclined a little sideways as a connoisseur might gaze upon a doubtful work of art.
Oh, she said. He'll make a lovely corpse.
Bah! Humbug! Out on a merry Christmas. What's Christmas time to you but a time for finding yourself a year older and not an hour richer?
If I had my will, every idiot who goes about with a merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried. buried with a stake of holly through his heart. So he should.
I'm working late tonight, Master Copperfield. I'm improving my legal knowledge. I'm going through Tidsy's practice. Oh, what a writer Mr. Tidsy is, Master Copperfield.
Well, I suppose you're quite a great lawyer now, then, Uriah.
Me, Master Copperfield? Oh, no, I'm a very humble person. I'm well aware that I'm about the humblest person going. Let the other be where he may. My mother's likewise a very humble person. We live in humble abodes, Master Copperfield. We have much to be thankful for. My father's former calling was humble. He was a sexton.
And, what is he now?
He's a partaker of glory at present, Master Copperfield.
He gave his audiences the characters they knew and loved, but he also introduced them to quite new and fresh creations. A market salesman, a landlady, a waiter in a station refreshment room.
I'm the boy at Mugby, that's about what I am. You know what I mean?
I think you do. I think you must.
Look here, I am the boy at what is called the refreshment room at Mugby Junction, what's proudly supposed is it never yet refreshed any mortal being.
You ask a boy so situated next time you stop in a hurry at Mugby for anything to drink, you take particular notice, he'll try to seem not to hear you. And he'll appear in an absent manner to survey the railway line through a transparent medium composed of your head and body. That's me! Oh, what a delightful lark it is. You should see our bandolining room at Mugby Junction, where our missus and our young ladies bandolines their hair. You should see them at it, twixt trains, bandolining away, as if they was anointing themselves for a combat. And when the train's due, you should see our young ladies begin to pitch the stale pastry out of the plates and chuck the sawdust sandwiches under the glass covers. And then, when the train arrives, you should see our missus holding the public in check most beautiful, her eyes omitting sparks, her hair almost a coming unbandolined with rage. In all my time, I never seen half so many cups of tea without milk given to people as wanted it with, nor half so many cups of tea with milk given it to them as wanted it without. Oh, I enjoyed the refreshment in trade all over again, and I was so glad I took to it when young. Whoever would begin to be worried with letting lodgings that wasn't a lone woman with a living to get is a thing inconceivable to me, my dears. Excuse the familiarity. It becomes natural when wishing to open my mind to those I can trust, and I should be truly thankful if that was all mankind, but such is not so. For have but a room to let sign in your window, and you watch on the mantelpiece and farewell to it if you turn your back for a second, however gentlemanly the manners. Nor is being of your own sex any safeguard, as I have reason in the form of sugar tongs to know. For that lady, and a fine woman she was, got me to run for a glass of water on the plea of going to be confined. It certainly turned out to be true, but it was the police station. I'm a market cheap, Jack. You know what that is, do you? No, you don't. I'll show you. Here I am on the footboard of my cart in the marketplace on a Saturday night. I put up a general miscellaneous lot. I says, now, my free and independent voters, I'm going to show you what I'm going to do with you. I'm going to give you such a chance as you never had in all your born days, nor yet the days preceding. Now, I'll tell you what I'm going to do with you. Here's a pair of razors that will shave you closer than the Board of Guardians. Here's a flat iron worth its weight in gold. Here's a frying pan, artificially flavoured with essence of beef steaks to that degree that you've only got for the rest of your lives to fry bread and dripping in it, and there you are, replete with animal food. Now here's a dozen dinner plates that you may play the cymbals with to charm the baby when it's fractious. Stop! I'll throw you in another article, and I'll give you that, and that's a rolling pin. And if the baby can only get it well into its mouth when its teeth is coming through and rub the gums once with it, they'll come through double in a fit of laughter equal to being tickled. Stop again! I'll throw you in another article, because I don't like the looks of you. For you don't have the appearance of buyers. And that article's a looking glass in which you may see how ugly you look when you don't bid. Now, what you say now, eh? 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 What you say?
What'd you say?
Do you say a pound? No, you don't. Not you. You haven't got it. Do you say 10 shillings? Not you. You are more of the landlord. Well, then I'll tell you what I'll do with you. I'll heap them all up on the footboard of the cart. There they are. Razors, flat arm, frying pan, dinner plates, rolling pin and looking glass. Take them all away for 4 shillings and I'll give you 6 months for your trouble. Now, do you know what I am? I'm a cheap jack.
Dickens was always exhausted after each performance. He went backstage and took off his clothes, which were wet with sweat. He'd have a glass of brandy and water, or perhaps a sip of iced champagne, and then they were off again. In Liverpool, 3,000 people were turned away from his reading. In Glasgow, 2 files of policemen kept the crowds from the doors of the City Hall. Yet even as he toured the country, he was writing his next novel, The Tale of Two Cities. And even as he was doing the readings and writing the novel, he was editing a new weekly periodical called All the Year Round. He was buoyed up, you see, by the celebration which greeted him everywhere. It gave him the energy and purpose of his life. It gave him the will to carry on. Ride on. Ride on. Over all obstacles. And win the race. He felt that he'd faced down his past. You see. He marked his break with that past in an even more direct way. He burned all his letters in the garden of his house at Gad's Hill. This was the house, by the way, that his father had shown him as a child in Rochester, telling him that if he worked hard enough, he might one day own it. Well, now he did. The letters he was burning in that garden were from Thackeray, from Carlyle, from Tennyson, George Eliot, from Wilkie Collins, all consumed in the funeral pyre of his past. Whatever you do, dear friend, he wrote to someone at the time, don't look back. So what did Dickens do? He wrote Great Expectations, in which he entirely rewrites his own past. Never has a novel been so filled with the horrors of childhood. As I draw closer and closer to the end, he said, I travel in the circle nearer and nearer to the beginning. But after Great Expectations, he was planning another reading tour. But before beginning it, he went on a short holiday to visit Ellen Ternan in the little retreat he'd rented for her and her mother in France, near Boulogne. He was now constantly travelling on the ferry between the two countries. On this occasion, they came back and took the 2:38 tidal train from Folkestone to London. But there was something wrong with the track. Some rails had been taken off from a viaduct and set aside for repair work just at the time when the train was approaching them at a speed of 50 miles per hour. The train jumped the gap of 42 feet and more than half of its carriages fell across a viaduct into the bed of the river below. The carriage in which Dickens and the Turnans were travelling hung over the viaduct at an angle. The women screamed, but Dickens calmed them down, got them free, put them in a horse carriage, away from prying eyes. Then he saw 2 guards running up and down. Look at me, he said to the men, and tell me if you don't recognise me. We know you very well, Mr. Dickens, they replied. Whereupon Dickens immediately began to organise the mission for help. He filled his top hat with water and started working among the dead and the dying. It was at this point that he suddenly remembered he had left that month's manuscript of Our Mutual Friend in the swaying carriage, so he climbed right back inside again and retrieved it. And despite that heroic episode, or perhaps because of it, his self-possession was never again complete. He became ill and fearful in travelling upon trains. He was plagued with sudden, vague rushes of terror. But who could stop him? He was himself very much like the locomotive, speeding towards its crash. Dickens could no more stop himself than he could stop breathing. He had to go on. He was now quite lame and suffering attacks upon his side and upon his heart. Nonetheless, he undertook the second reading tour of Britain. It was a triumph, but it completely exhausted him. All the more astonishing, then, that he should decide immediately afterwards to embark on a reading tour of the United States of America, though he was obliged to travel everywhere by the one form of transport he now most dreaded, the train. Again, it was a triumph. Perhaps the single greatest triumph of his entire career. But this time, it really shattered him. On his return to England, he found that he could no longer work at his old pace. His elasticity of bearing was somewhat impaired, his friend Forster wrote, and the wonderful brightness of eye was dimmed at times. Curiously enough, he could only read the top half of the letters over shop doors. Nonetheless, he continued to add new readings to his repertory. One afternoon, in the summer of 1868, his son heard a violent quarrel in the field outside the country house. Two people were engaged in a serious and terrible uproar. He stepped outside, anxiously, only to see his father striding up and down, gesticulating wildly in the characters of Bill Sykes and Nancy, with every circumstance of the most aggravated brutality, as the Sun reported. Dickens was preparing his next set of public readings. His friends begged him not to perform the terrible scene of Nancy's death. The realism he brought to it terrified his audience and shattered him physically and emotionally, but he was quite adamant it must be included. He hardly knew why he felt compelled to enter into the heart of darkness. He simply knew he had to. Did he have his wife somewhere in mind? Or was it all women who had so obsessed him throughout his life, even perhaps Ellen Ternan? But then he also took on the voice of Nancy, screaming and pleading with Bill up to the very point of her death. He was murderer and victim, man and woman. Dickens wrote out his script by hand, heavily italicizing certain words. Stage directions fill the margins of his copy of Oliver Twist. Beckon down. Point. Shudder. Turn round with terror. Murder coming. Mystery. Terror through to the end. Get up!
Is that you, Bill?
Get up! There was a candle burning, but Sykes withdrew it from the candlestick and hurled it under the grate. Seeing the faint light of early day without, the girl rose to undraw the curtain.
Let it be. There's light enough for what I gotta do.
Bill? Bill? What you look at me like that for?
The robber regarded her for a few seconds with dilated nostrils and heaving breast. Then, grasping her by the head and throat, dragged her into the middle of the room and placed his heavy hand upon her mouth.
You were watched tonight, you she-devil! Every word you said was heard!
Leave every word I said was heard! It was heard! I spared you, Bill! Bill, you cannot have the heart to kill me! Bill, for God's sake, for your own sake, for mine! Stop before you spill my blood! I have been true to you! About my guilty soul, I have!
The housebreaker freed one arm and grasped his pistol. The certainty of immediate detection if he fired it flashed across his mind. He beat it thrice upon the upturned face that almost touched his own. She staggered and fell, nearly blinded with the blood that rained down from a gash in her forehead. But raising herself on her knees, she drew from her bosom a white handkerchief, and holding it up towards heaven, breathed one prayer for mercy to her Maker. But the ghastly figure to look upon. The murderer staggered backwards towards the wall and, shutting out the sight with his hand, seized a heavy club and struck her down! The bright sun burst upon the crowded city in clear and radiant glory, through costly coloured glass and paper-mended window, through cathedral dome and rotten crevice it shed its equal ray. It lighted up the room where the murdered woman lay. It did. He tried to shut it out, but it would stream in. If the sight had been a ghastly one in the dull morning, what was it now in all that brilliant light? He had not moved. had been afraid to stir. Then there was a moan, an emotion of her hand. And with terror added to rage, she had struck her again and again and again and again and again and again and again. There was the body, mere flesh and blood, no more, but such flesh and so much blood, the stains were dispersed about the room. The very feet of his dog were bloody. All this time, he had never once turned his back upon the corpse. He now moved backward toward the door, dragging the dog with him. Shut the door softly. Locked it. Took the key. And left the house. After completing that second reading tour, Dickens rested all that summer of 1861. Of course, he didn't rest. He started writing his next novel, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, a novel of murder and opium addiction and double identity. One day, his eldest son, Charles, came into the room where his father was writing. If you don't want anything more, sir, I shall be off now. No answer. Silence. He raised his head and looked at me long and fixedly. But I soon found that although his eyes were bent upon me and he seemed to be looking at me earnestly, he did not see me. That he was, in fact, unconscious for the moment of my very existence. He was in dreamland with Edwin Drood. And I left him. Despite his physical and mental exhaustion over the years, his work had lost nothing of its unique, inventive expansiveness. A late novel like Our Mutual Friend, where the comic and the sublime wander through the echo chamber of London, brims over with hilarity. Mr. and Mrs. Podsnap requested the honour of the company of 17 friends at dinner to celebrate the 18th birthday of their little Georgiana. Hideous solidity was the characteristic of the Podsnap plate. Everything was made to look as heavy as it could and to take up as much room as possible. The majority of the guests were like the plate and included several very heavy articles weighing ever so much. A foreign gentleman was among them, and there was a droll disposition, not only on the part of Mr. Podsnap, but of everybody else, to treat him as if he were a child who was hard of hearing. "How do you like London?" asked Mr. Podsnap. "London, Londra, London." The foreign gentleman admired it. "You find it very large?" said Mr. Podsnap, spaciously. The foreign gentleman found it very large and very rich. The foreign gentleman found it, without doubt, énormément riche. Enormously rich, we say. Enormously rich, attempted the foreign gentleman. "And do you find, sir, many evidences that strike you of our British constitution in the streets of the world's metropolis? London, Londra, London. We Englishmen are very proud of our constitution, sir. It was bestowed upon us by Providence. No other country is so favoured as this country."
"And other countries?"
"Other! In England. Anglaterre, England. We do not say
there.
We say other. The letters are T and H. The sound is th. Th. Th.
And the countries?"
asked the foreign gentleman. "This island was blessed, sir, to the direct exclusion of such other countries, as there may happen to be. There is in an Englishman a combination of qualities.
modesty, an independence, a responsibility, a repose, combined with an absence of everything calculated to call a blush into the cheek of a young person, which one would seek in vain among the nations of the earth. Having delivered this little summary, with his favourite right arm flourish, Mr. Podsnap put the rest of Europe, as well as the whole of Asia, Africa, and America, nowhere. In January of 1870, despite desperately poor health, Dickens embarked on a new season of readings, after every one of which he was so exhausted that he had to be carried backstage and laid on a sofa. He could not speak coherently for 10 minutes afterwards. Even during these readings themselves, he sometimes found it hard to pronounce the words accurately. Pickwick became Pickswick, Picnic, Peckwicks. And he continued to play the scene of the murder of Nancy. He might just as well have wielded the club against himself, since these final, agonized public performances to all intents and purposes killed him. He was now utterly dazed and worn. He ate little. He could not sleep. His left foot swelled. He was close to a paralytic stroke. His family doctor came to see him and instantly ordered him to stop. He was killing himself. Finally, even Dickens himself realized that he could no longer continue. The very last performance of all, at the St. James's Hall in London, he read A Christmas Carol and the trial scene from Pickwick. The applause at the end was overwhelming. Holding up his hand to silence it, Dickens said, "From the earliest years of my career down to this proud night, I have always tried to be true to my calling. I hope that the public believe that with a host of imperfections and shortcomings upon my head, I have, as a writer, in my soul and conscience, tried to be as true to them as they have ever been to me. These garish lights, I vanish now forevermore with a heartfelt, grateful, respectful, and affectionate farewell." He returned to the country, to Gad's Hill, where he continued working on Edwin Drood. On Wednesday, the 8th of June, contrary to his usual custom, he wrote all day. He came down to dinner, and Georgina Hogarth noticed an alteration in his colour and his expression. She asked him if he were ill, and he replied, "Yes, very ill. I've been very ill for the last hour." He said that he wanted to go to London immediately, but then he experienced a fit against which he tried to struggle. He stopped and then started talking rapidly and indistinctly. The family got up from their chairs, and Georgina told him to come and lie down. "Yes," he said, "upon the ground." Those were the last words he uttered. He slipped from her arms and fell heavily to the floor. Upon the ground. Perhaps even in his extremity he was recalling the words of one of his characters, Louisa Gradgrind in Hard Times. "I shall die if you hold me. Let me fall upon the ground." He was imitating, literally becoming, his characters until the very end. He lingered all that day. 5 minutes before 6 in the evening, his breathing suddenly diminished and he began to sob. He sobbed for 15 minutes. Heaved a deep sigh. A tear rose to his right eye and trickled down his cheek. And he was dead. 58 years old. At the funeral service in Westminster Abbey, he was buried next to Samuel Johnson and near the busts of Handel, Milton, Chaucer,
and Shakespeare. The oration perfectly caught the mood of the country. He whose loss we now mourn occupied during his lifetime a greater space in the minds of Englishmen than any other writer. We read him, we talked about him, we acted him, we laughed with him. We were roused by him to a consciousness of the misery of others and to a sympathetic interest in human life. Men seem to have lost not a great writer only, but one whom they had personally known. And so we bid him farewell. And in the midst of all this stood Mr. Pickwick. Let us leave our old friend in one of those moments of unmixed happiness of which, if we seek them, there are ever some to cheer our transitory existence here. There are dark shadows on the earth, but its lights are stronger in the contrast. Some men, like bats or owls, have better eyes for the darkness than for the light. We who have no such optical powers are better pleased to take our last parting look at our visionary companions. And the brief sunshine of this world is blazing full upon them.
The Mystery of Charles Dickens by Peter Ackroyd was directed for BBC Radio 4 by Gemma McMullen and is published on audio by BBC Worldwide.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.